So I'm going to go over some material that I go over a lot. You always hear me talk about the life of the Buddha and how he awakened. But again, it fits into this the context of these teachings this weekend. And part of it is to understand how the Buddha came to these understandings, these conclusions, and what led him there. So I'll read a little bit of the article, talk a little bit about it. A quote from the Buddha describing what needs to be done. And so all of you know that I tend to shy away from the mystical and the esoteric. And notice, I learned that, I think I was talking to Howard just a little bit before, maybe Mark. When I first got interested in Eastern religion, I saw this movie called Lost Horizon. Anybody see that movie? It's about, I think it was 1938, maybe 1940. It's about this mythical kingdom of Shangri-La in the Himalayas. And it was discovered by this pilot right before the war who crashed in the Himalayas, Ram remembers. And he was wandering around in the snowy mountains, and he found himself saved by these. I can't remember if it was it might have been a nun. Do you remember? But he ended up in this, in the middle of the Himalayas, but in this beautiful valley that was warm. Everybody's happy. There's a wise old teacher that, you know, wasn't that all that accessible, but if you got to talk to him, you got some good stuff. People lived for a couple hundred years. It was rather vague. Everybody was happy. Everything was beautiful. And it was implied that this was a Buddhist community. So that was for me. And that was my introduction, was this kind of mystical way, a way of living a life that is free of the entanglements of the world, but in a kind of a mystical way. So that's what I wanted. A few years later, I was given two books, Siddhartha, the novel by Hermann Hesse, and the next day, Think on These Things by Krishnamurti. And I think I was 19 or so, and it just blew me away. Up until that point, I was very disappointed in my life because nothing makes sense. All the things that I was told I should be moving towards, I should be wanting to get a good career and find the perfect woman and get the perfect house and all these things. They were reasonable goals, but they just didn't seem useful to me. They didn't seem meaningful. Why should I spend my whole life chasing after these things? It seemed like I was talking to Mark about this before, and I talk about this a lot to people. It seemed to me there just had to be more than what I was being told. And from an early age, I was disappointed in my life, and there was no reason for that. I had a loving family, middle class, I have everything we wanted. But something was missing. And I remembered the TV show The Waltons. The father was Ralph Waite. People remember that. And I read a quote of his in the TV Guide, of all places. Talk about Enlightening magazine. And he was talking about his own life. And he ended up turning to the bottle and drugs for quite a few years like I did. And one of the things that he said kind of led him in that way is that he had this great life, but there just wasn't enough of it. And that's what I felt like. I had this great life, but something's missing. And what was missing is I didn't know what was going on. The Buddha felt the same way. He was brought up, the prince in this wonderful kingdom in northern India, southern Nepal. And his whole life, he had this gnawing feeling that there's something missing in this life, even though his father gave him everything any kid could want. And so at the age of 29, he left the palace grounds, and he saw, everybody's heard this story, he saw a sick person, an old person. What struck him the most was there's a person laying on the road, and he asked Chanda, his assistant, he says, "Why is that man sleeping on the side of the road?" And Chanda said, "He's not sleeping, he's dead." And for the first time in the Buddha's life, it hit him, like all of us. We all know that there's death in human life. But like most of us, he didn't really think about it, and he certainly didn't apply it to himself. And so this gnawing thing that he had going on with him coalesced at that point, and he realized the meaninglessness of the competitive nature of life. everybody's chasing after acquiring things, whether it's wealth or power or position, when we all end up like that. And that's what set the Buddha off on his course. He says, I need to understand this. I need to understand why people spend their lives chasing things when you end up like that. You can't take nothing with you. So let me read a little bit of this. So one of the things that he said, because this is from the Dhammapada. On his awakening, he understood what we do to create a meaningless life, no matter what we acquire. And so what he said was abandoning unskillful thoughts, words, and actions, developing skillful thoughts, words, and actions, and purifying one's mind. This is the purpose of the Buddhist teachings. Now, if you've heard that saying in different ways, that's my paraphrase just to make the point. Purifying one's mind. This is the purpose of the Buddhist teaching. In that one paragraph, he's laying it all on the line, but he's also saying it's not that difficult. This is what it is. This is what he's trying to teach. And now he'll show you why. Why is this important? Siddhartha Gautama was the son of a local king. At the age of 29, having confronted sickness, aging, and death for the first time, Siddhartha left home and set out seeking to understand the natures of the struggles and disappointing nature of human life. He wanted to understand why there was such competitiveness and aggressiveness between humans when all humanity was subject to the same problems and limitations of sickness, aging, and death, and the fleeting nature of acquisition and achievement. So he was in a unique position even back then of seeing great wealth being developed, and in the blink of an eye, it's gone. And he could see, and that happened all around him. There was just as much conflict in northern India at that time as there is in our life today. The similarities are remarkable. He would wander an area of what is today the borderland of India and Nepal for 6 years, never leaving a 400-square-mile area. His discoveries would spread across the globe and remain relevant for over 2,600 years. We're here today because of those first teachings. We're the living example of a true lineage of the Dhamma, right here in this room. He would study with the foremost spiritual teachers and develop the most advanced meditation techniques of his time. He found the teachings and the meditation techniques lacking in developing the understanding he sought. He studied with the local Brahmins, Alara Kalama and Udeka Ramaputta. And what they were teaching was what was a spiritual dharma that they developed out of the Vedas. The Vedas had been in existence for quite a while now. And the Vedas were what was influencing most spiritual thought at the time. And everybody had their own little way of looking at it. And after the Vedas, the Upanishads came kind of as a Protestant reaction to the Vedas, although they ended up getting all mixed together. So the Buddha studied these teachings, and he found them lacking in developing an understanding of what he wanted. They were true spiritual dharmas. You could engage in them. You could have mystical and magical experiences, which the Buddha had. He when you read his account of studying with these teachers, he had incredible experiences. But in the end, he realized they're not leading him anywhere. In the end, they realized he was just creating another ego-based self on these teachings. So, and they both of those teachers wanted him to come and be their assistants and even take over their teachings because they were so impressed with how the Buddha understood these teachings. Along with five friends he met along the way, he then engaged in severe ascetic practices, thinking that this extreme denial of human needs would somehow free him from the bonds and struggles of physical existence. This was a common view that continues today in many forms. The more you can deny yourself, the more you'll free your mind or free your soul. It still goes on in northern India. It still goes on right here. Sometimes it's not quite as severe as what the Buddha did, but any extreme behavior chasing enlightenment is the same type of ascetic practices, and that's done often today. And I won't get too deep into that, but you can imagine why that's so. If I'm denying my basic needs, where is that coming from? It's coming from this self-referential ego self, which is the only thing that can decide what basic needs are. It's reaffirming the belief, and that's why it's, as the Buddha said, it's painful, low, and common. It doesn't lead to the goal. It just reinforces a self-referential ego self. After 6 years of seeking, severely weakened from his ascetic practices, he abandoned this extreme behavior. After gaining strength from proper nutrition, he realized that his manner of seeking was rooted in an extreme view, resulting in extreme behavior. From this initial right view, he generated the right intention to recognize and abandon all views and resulting actions that were blocking him from his understanding. So when the Buddha describes his teaching, he says it's a teaching that is the middle way. It avoids the extreme views of complete sensory indulgence. He knew that when he was living in the palace. And the extreme view of complete denial of human needs. And then he described that middle way. The middle way is the Eightfold Path. And he consistently presented it that way. So if you think about that, about fully engaging in the path then guides you through our own extreme views. And it's not just extreme views of eating chocolate cake every night. And it's not just an extreme view of severe asceticism, but it's extreme views of establishing a practice that only creates more self-referential establishment. That's an extreme view. That's what the Eightfold Path is there to avoid. And we want to do that. Why? Because of our own conditioned mind. I mean, I'm saying we as humanity. So we'll attach ourselves to things, even so-called spiritual practices. We'll wholeheartedly engage in them because they allow us in some way to engage and keep a self-referential ego self. A good example of that are some of the practices that teach to do certain things so that at some point a Buddha nature will arise in you. The Buddha never taught anything about like that. And if you think about that, what are you doing? You're transferring the establishment of a self-referential ego self from something that's not working for you to something else that's not likely to work for you, but it sounds good. Inside me is a Buddha nature. Well, the Buddha never said that. The Buddha said what you think of yourself is anatta. Let go of those views because it's the views that are hurting you, and that leads to dependent origination. Are you following me, though, where I'm going with this? And again, this is relating to the Buddha's life. So at the end of this 6 years of struggle and severe asceticism and trying these different techniques and then nearly dying, the story is that the Buddha was walking down the road one day and so weakened from eating a grain of rice or one bean for so long that he passed out and rolled into the river. And a little girl, I can't remember her name. Maura, do you remember her name? It's not that important, but a little girl pulled him out of the river and fed.
Yeah, it's a smile. Yeah. I don't know that she was little, but she was pretty.
this pretty bigger girl. Well, she must have been because she pulled the. Well, but he was only about 60 pounds.
Yeah, he was very.
She pulled the Buddha out of the river and nursed him back to health. And then he decided, he knew that those extreme views and those extreme practices that he was in is not leading him to the goal. It almost killed him. And that's when he started pointing his mind towards a middle way, a balance between these practices. And so he remembered a spontaneous meditation experience he had as a young child. He was about 5 years old and he was frustrated one day. And he just said, I'm going to sit here until I feel better. And this meditation practice came on the Buddha, which is Shamatha Vipassana meditation. He remembered a spontaneous meditation experience he had as a young child and decided to use this meditation method to hopefully clear his mind. He found a quiet, secluded spot under a pipal tree, sat on the ground with his legs crossed in front of him, and placed his mindfulness on his breath. For the next 40 days, Siddhartha remained focused in Shamatha Vipassana meditation. As conditioned thoughts and thought constructs arose, he gained insight into the impermanence of thoughts and that the origination of these thoughts were rooted in ignorance. Tuesday, I gave a talk on meta and metaphor, and that was the article this week. Did any of you or many of you read it? Because it relates to the use of metaphor throughout the Pali Canon. And so when you read the accounts of the Buddha's final meditation before he's awakened, the way his confused, deluded mental fabrications are portrayed is through the deity Mara. And so Mara was kept coming at the Buddha in meditation. First, Mara sent the army to try to knock the Buddha off his cushion. And he sat there and recognized it just as a mental fabrication. He saw the impermanence in it. And the armies faded away. Next, Mara sent elephants to trample the Buddha. And the Buddha. And if you can imagine this, these are just the Buddha's mental constructs. They're the anguish of a confused, deluded mind that's coming to him during meditation. And he's recognizing them as impermanent mental constructs. As each one arose, he saw it as such, brushed it aside. And Mara, or his own consciousness, kept coming after him and coming after him during this meditation. We've all had that, haven't we? We don't recognize it as Mara usually. Some people do. But when we're having difficulty quieting our minds, when we're distracted by our own thoughts, that's Mara, metaphorically. We're having that same experience that the Buddha did. And so he went through this process of seeing every one of these mental fabrications arise in his mind. And he saw them as such and he let them go. And he went through this process. And after 40 days, again, the legend has it that he looked up and saw the morning sky, morning star rising. And he awakened. And what he awakened to was that of these four truths that he saw very clearly for the first time in human history. And what he said, what he recognized, that the cause of that problem was ignorance of these four truths. We don't understand the nature of reality. That's the first link in dependent origination. Ignorance of the Four Noble Truths leads to the 12 observable causative links that ends in suffering. Let me get back to the story a little bit. Siddhartha used a simple meditation method to gain sufficient concentration to develop insight into the three marks of existence. Upon developing profound understanding of the nature of suffering and the interplay between the impermanent phenomenal world and a misunderstanding of what constitutes a self, Siddhartha's mind cleared. He was now able to view human life through profound right view. He was an arahant, a rightly self-awakened human being. Being the first, he was given the title of the Buddha. He never referred to himself as that, though. He referred to himself as the Tathagata, which means the one who has gone forth and who left the distraction of the world behind and achieved liberation from dukkha through dispelling ignorance. So the difference between the Buddha and all other awakened beings is he saw this clearly for the first time, and he developed a very simple way to teach others, to give them that same experience of an arahant, of an awakened human being. And that's the only difference that the Buddha placed between himself and other people that would awaken. He never elevated himself above human beings in any other way. He certainly didn't set himself up to be a god in a long, infinite lineage of gods. He consistently said, I'm a human being. If I can do it, you can do it. And that's how that's the true message of the Ratana Sutta and taking refuge. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. The Buddha awakened to the profound understanding that the cause of dukkha, the cause of the underlying unsatisfactory nature of life, is rooted in ignorance. This is a specific ignorance that results in a pervasive ignorance. In other words, it feeds on itself from that initial ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. It continues with human beings wandering endlessly in samsara, is the way it's often portrayed. Because we don't understand these four simple and direct truths, we can't make any sense out of our lives, yet we'll continue to struggle within that deluded state, conditioned thinking, confirmation bias. This is what the Buddha saw, and so he realized we needed a direct path to get out of that, to recognize this thinking. Again, it's what Mark was talking about earlier. It is ignorance of the Four Noble Truths that through 12 observable causative links results in all manner of human confusion, delusion, and suffering. This often misunderstood and misapplied teaching is known as dependent origination. His very first discourse then was to explain the Four Noble Truths to bring direct wisdom to where there was once ignorance. So the Buddha awakened to dependent origination, but he didn't teach that until months and months and maybe a few years later into his teaching. And the reason why is that the context for understanding this wasn't established yet. So what he taught in his very first teaching, and this is what we're going to go through this weekend, was the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the sutta where, for the first time, he set the wheel of truth in motion. He taught the Four Noble Truths. He taught the Four Noble Truths to explain what happens through that chain of dependent origination. Rooted in ignorance through 12 causative links, we end up in the suffering that's established in the First Noble Truth. Is that clear?
Yeah.
So the Buddha presented the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the sutta setting the wheel of truth in motion, to his five friends. Upon hearing this discourse, Kandana declared, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. Seems pretty simple. In fact, most of us would say that's obvious, but he understood that at the most penetrating level. And he was referring also to himself. recognizing the conditioned nature, conditioned mind, the conditioned nature of himself. All conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation, which points to the ongoing process of becoming. And I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but I'm going to go there anyway, which also points to karma and rebirth. If we're always in a constant process of becoming, which we are, then the choice is, if we can remain mindful of the choice of the Eightfold Path, is to continue becoming awakened. And if we dismiss that, or we simply continue our ignorance of it, we can only continue more ignorance. And that's the choice that we have in each and every moment. That's the potential in each moment. It's the potential to continue ignorance or to develop the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. And that's what those 12 causative links refer to. And the reason why I'm saying it this way is some people get hung up on trying to understand the 12 causative links, and it becomes very frustrating because you really can't understand it until you develop the other teachings that the Buddha first presented that we're going to go through this weekend. Did you have a question? No?
No, I was going to say that when you said something about that the Buddha recognized that all things that come into existence will cease, you know, dependent. And I think that you said, well, we all know that, right? So we all know impermanence, you know, people say, so it'll pass, you know, but like really understanding that at the subtle levels is very different. It's that experience.
Quite different.
And then I think that not everybody does understand that because all the conditioned mental states that arise in the process of meditation are also subject to ceasing, except full awakening.
Yeah.
So that's all that the Buddha went through in his... I think that's what he got so disillusioned with. Well, these are all conditioned states.
It's all impermanent. Yeah. Just like that body on the side of the road. That's the perfect example of impermanence. But what he also understood is the interplay, the three marks of existence, between anicca,
yeah,
impermanence, the not-self characteristic. Mm-hmm. So you think about that; those two things, leave dukkha aside for a moment. All things are impermanent, including this thing called anatta that we don't see it as impermanent. We see it as well-established. We think that we are permanent. In fact, the common teachings of the time of reincarnation was that this same soul continues on and on and on and on and on forever. And that leads to more delusion, doesn't it? In fact, the way that a lot of those religions were taught is that the main purpose is to don't be too concerned with your suffering. Just live a good life because you're going to get a better life next one. The Buddha saw the futility in that. He saw the impermanence of it. He understood that there's no permanent entity that travels from one life to another. There can't be. Everything is in a process of becoming. Everything is impermanent. Including those views that would hold those things to be true. And that's what creates the real agitation and confusion in our minds. Because we decide that this is permanent, this is me, and it's always going to be me. It's never going to change. And the practical example of that is most people conclude who they are in relation to the world by the time they're about 14 or 15. That's just how our minds work. You know, it takes us to be about 7, 8, 9 before we can have any real self-reflection. And then those next 6 or 7 years, we form very hardened views. Most of them has to do with our environment. A lot of it has to, you know, comes from our parents and maybe the schools we're at and our friends, what we're into. But by the time we're 15 or 16, we've pretty well established how we're going to see the world. That doesn't mean we don't learn anything. Then we might go to college and we'll learn specific skills and do other things and that are applied in a practical way. But our views of the world are set. And we think that this is all we are. When the Buddha left at the age of 29, he had those views, but they didn't make sense to him because he noticed impermanence around him. And he noticed the futility of people's lives. He wondered, why do we engage in this competitiveness and this aggressiveness? And he wanted to understand that. And what he realized was that we do that because we're continually trying to establish a self. And if I have an ego self, the main way that I can establish it is make sure that it's a little bit better than you. And that sets this whole chain of competitiveness. I need to have a new car every year. I need to have the bigger house. I need to have this or that. I need to have the perfect girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever it might be. And whatever it is that we establish as an identity, we start attaching ourselves to that. That's clinging. And so we continue down this road, no matter what we have, needing more and more and more, because the ego, the self-referential ego self, is insatiable. No matter what it's attached to, it needs more, because anatta must establish itself in every thought, word, object, event, and idea that occurs. That's why it's so difficult to quiet our minds, especially when we're first beginning to meditate, and we're trying to create that little bit of separation between thoughts. It's so difficult because that's an example of clinging. One thought clinging to the next thought to the next thought. It's a self-referential thought. One thought following another thought. It's me, me, me. And when we first start putting some space in there, it can often be very painful and fearful because it feels like annihilation. Where am I going? What's going to happen to me? Especially if I let go of all these views that are rooted in ignorance. So the Buddha's second discourse, well, when the Buddha heard Khandana say that, he said, now you are known as Anakandana, which means the one who understands. Khandana heard this simple teaching on the Four Noble Truths and got it at such a deep level that he was now the second awakened human being. He was an arahant. The Buddha's second discourse, the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, teaches the confusion and contradictions of conceit or eye-making that results from ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. So just going back to the first teaching, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, in a broad sense, the Four Noble Truths teaches impermanence. And so I'll explain that. The Buddha starts teaching like a good doctor would teach or describe the problem you have, describing the common problem of humanity. There is an underlying disappointing nature to life. There is dukkha. And then he said, craving originates and clinging perpetuates that suffering. Then he said the most important aspect of that, pointing to impermanence, cessation of suffering is possible. There's a way out of this. That's pointing to impermanence. If there wasn't such a thing of impermanence, we'd be stuck in this existence. But the Buddha recognized that there was a skillful application of permanence. It doesn't just lead to suffering. And then the path to develop impermanence and final resolution of suffering is the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path is primarily there so we can recognize these ever-fleeting mental fabrications that are holding us into a bondage of an ego self. Is that clear? And so as we develop this refined mindfulness rooted in the concentration that's developed in Shamatha Vipassana meditation, we're able to see this process occurring. We're able to see the ongoing eye-making in each thought that we have. We first have to quiet our minds enough to see it. Shamatha means to quiet the mind. Vipassana means to gain insight. But it's a very specific type of insight. That second aspect, Vipassana, has been misused in recent years too, where there's only a Vipassana practice. Well, the Buddha never taught that. Consistently, he taught Shamatha Vipassana, develop a well-concentrated mind. So within the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, we can gain a very specific insight. And what is it insight to? To the Four Noble Truths. That's why the Buddha taught it. Insight into the nature of suffering, insight into the nature of craving and clinging that continues to establish a confused, deluded ego self. Hard words, but those are the words. That's what we're doing. I don't want to go too late tonight. So the third, and we're going to go over these over the course of the weekend. His third discourse was the Aditya Parya Sutta, the Fire Discourse. In this sutta, the Buddha describes in simple detail how from basic ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, conceit arises and is reinforced by craving and clinging born of passion, resulting in ongoing dukkha. So, I hope I'm being clear that what I'm laying down right now, tonight, is the foundation for the weekend, for what we're going to learn. And what we're learning in a very profound and direct way is the three marks of existence. We're going to understand the Buddha's teaching on the Four Noble Truths, impermanence. We're going to understand what the Buddha was teaching in the Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, the not-self characteristic, what he really means by anatta, and he doesn't mean emptiness or nothingness. The second aspect of that, those three marks of existence. And the fire discourse teaches how dukkha arises from passion. Passion meaning craving and clinging for a establishment and the continuation of an ego personality, rooted in that first part of the dependent origination, rooted in ignorance. We simply don't know. And that's what the entire Buddha's teaching is, to teach us how those three marks of existence interplay, to keep us stuck in suffering, and how to work our way out of it by seeing it clearly, by seeing that interaction clearly. As our minds quiet and we integrate the Eightfold Path shows us how that happens. Many people, when they first start taking to the Dhamma, especially in a direct way, find right speech very useful in recognizing where they're clinging and where they're craving, and I think probably most of you would say that. It's almost like an aha moment when you start looking at right speech and you start seeing how your words are used in a way to continue this ego self. We use them in a competitive way. We use them sometimes in a hurtful way to make ourselves better than somebody else. You know, that's what gossip is all about. Or we might tell little lies. Those little lies are keeping us able to maintain this ego personality in a certain way, not facing the truth. We do it with ourselves constantly. That's why I always say right speech should be applied to ourselves too. Look at the stories you're telling yourself. Look what comes up in our minds as we start to quiet our minds and develop some concentration. We can see clearly these things that were these mental fabrications that the Buddha saw as Mara in his meditation. One of the points that I wanted to make about that, Mara, the Buddha often used this metaphor and often used specifically Mara, but he always used, when he was using a deity in that way, it was always a malevolent, hurtful deity that he was using to describe these mental fabrications. He was pointing out very clearly in a very direct way what we're doing to ourselves. We're the malevolent deity Mara that's doing this to ourselves. Again, pointing back to that teaching on anatta, what you think of yourself is not a self, let it go. And that's all that he meant by it. He didn't mean to get into any mystical aspects of emptiness or nothingness, or that somehow within anatta is a Buddha nature or Buddhahood. He said all of those views are rooted in ignorance. Let go of all of them. During our retreat, there will be talks and Sangha discussions on dependent origination in the first three discourses. Most of you have studied these teachings through the Truth of Happiness Dhamma study or other presentations. It is my hope that reviewing these teachings in as close to the context as they were originally presented, additional insight will be developed into these four key teachings of the Buddha. So that's really the point, to see these teachings in the context and this in close proximity to each other. So give yourself time to look at this. Don't, you're not going to get it when you're hearing my words. You know, I'm not the Buddha, you're not Kandana. But what these teachings point to, and I think every one of us would understand that, we hear it, we start integrating it into our lives, we start developing a practice around these teachings, and then we see it, and then we see the practicality of it, right? And I think you've all had that experience. We start to see how it fits together. That's precisely how the Buddha taught. That's why he taught for 45 years. That's why I keep going back to Ananda. It took Ananda the entire Buddha's teaching career plus a month to get it, hearing it over and over again, hearing these concepts. But he finally got it. It was all worth it, wasn't it? When seen in sequential context, it is notable that the Buddha did not teach dependent origination immediately. There needed to be a contextual foundation in order to bring relevance to the understanding that it is ignorance of the four truths that leads to the formation of the 12-link chain of dependencies. The first three discourses then relate very closely to dependent origination in what may be at first overlooked. The Buddha's first teaching, where the Four Noble Truths were presented, explains a common human problem of disappointment, originating in craving and clinging, and that disappointment is an impermanent, though persistent experience, dependent on certain conditions. So, I think I might stop there. But just to explain that persistence, we often overlook the impermanent nature of things because of persistence, because of continuation of something. But continuation is, there's still impermanence underneath it. So, relating to the self, we think that this is a well-established self because we've had it since birth. It's the same self, and we're going to have it. But we fail to see the ongoing moment-by-moment becoming that we've established. And keeping it within this lifetime, it's not helpful to apply these teachings. It's often not helpful. Sometimes it is. But it's often not helpful to apply these teachings before birth and after death, because what's occurring is this human life. And the Buddha taught a path to awaken in this human life. We don't need to concern ourselves about where we might have come from or where we might go. When those questions were put to the Buddha, Vajragoda is a good example of that. Vajragoda the wanderer kept coming back into the Buddha's life, asking these same questions, the same basic questions. Where do I come from? What happens to me after I die? He would often say, he would ask it in a direct way. When the Tathagata dies, or when the Buddha dies, is the Buddha established or is the Buddha not established? And the Buddha would either just sit there like this, or he would say, Vajragoda, it's your questions that confuse you. Let go of the questions. The questions are rooted in ignorance. They're not valid questions. It's only an ignorant self-referential ego self, excuse the harsh language, that would want an answer to that question, because the question seeks to establish the self in some realm that's not relevant to right here, what's going on now. So the Buddha kept pointing everyone back to what's occurring in this present moment. Notice what you're making of yourself. And if you can understand that you have a choice about what you make of yourself. And if those choices are skillful choices rooted in the truth, rooted in an understanding that's developed through the Eightfold Path, then you will lead yourself towards awakening. The Buddha consistently said, ehepasiko. It's another misunderstood teaching. Many people have taken, ehepasiko means come and see for yourself. Many people take that and say, wow, that means that I can make this be anything I want. I can look at this any way that I want. What the Buddha was saying when he said that was, after teaching the Eightfold Path, now come and see for yourself how it works. Because the only way you can know is if you come and see for yourself. You have to experience that. Everything the Buddha taught was for an individual to have an experience. It's not something that can be imposed on us. It's not something that can be intellectually explained. That's of really very little value except to get you headed in the right direction. This path is to be developed by each individual that would do that, and so that each individual can awaken in this lifetime. I keep going back to that, but that's the important point. The Buddha wanted to find a way to develop lasting peace and happiness before we all end up on the side of the road in a heap. That was his concern. He wanted to do it, and he found a way to do it right now. That's the talk for tonight. That's the groundwork. any questions about that? I know I presented an awful lot of stuff in 15, 20 minutes, but any questions about it? Do you see where, did I lay the foundation well enough that you understand the foundation and how the rest of the teachings will fit into this? So tomorrow we're going to have...
Let me ask a question.
Please.
So you said at the end there, like in the Buddha teaching, you won't get the words exactly right, but you said something to the effect of, so you can choose to create any... We were basically talking about the power of karma. Pali, Sanskrit. That you have the power to choose to create yourself, in a sense, as you'd like it to be. So would you like to talk more about that?
Yeah, thank you for bringing it up. So you brought up the word kama or karma. I like to use the Pali words whenever I can, but when I say kama, people usually think it's that. It's not. So I use the word karma. So karma and rebirth are two very misunderstood teachings. The Buddha used the word karma in a different way than it was applied, but he used it anyway. The way karma was used by the Brahmins of his time was quite different, but it was still based on relating to an ongoing process. So karma and rebirth, the way it was usually portrayed was, if you do bad things in a future life, you're going to have bad things happen to you. And that's even a common, you know, the pop usage of, you're having a couple bad days, oh, I got bad karma. You know? But it has nothing to do with that. Karma, the way the Buddha uses it, and as it relates to the three marks of existence, is that karma is the present moment unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by the present moment mindfulness. And so what does that mean? If we have a mindfulness that is rooted in ignorance, karmas only can continue more ignorance. Karma means action. The actions that we're applying to what's occurring in this present moment are rooted in ignorance. Only ignorance can follow. Does that make sense? It really is that one-to-one equation.
My question was, you can create any self that you want. That was what you said.
Yes. So, as you refine your mindfulness, as you deepen your concentration and develop a refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, you now have a framework for your mindfulness. So as your karma unfolds, as your past intentional actions ripen, is a word that's often used, and bear fruit in this present moment, and your mindfulness is inclined towards awakening, that carries your karma. It alters the direction of your life in a very real way. And that's the only useful understanding of karma.
And anatta.
And anatta. Because anatta, who I think of myself in this moment happens to be who I think of myself, but it's not myself. Because if I can develop that refined mindfulness using the Eightfold Path as a framework, as a guide, then I am now turning my thoughts, words, and deeds towards developing awakening, away from ignorance. Each moment holds the potential to do that. Every one of us holds that potential within us. That's the real... That's the real beauty of understanding impermanence. We're not locked into anything if we're willing to look at our conditioned thinking. It's our conditioned thinking that keeps recreating the same experience, having the same desires, stuck in the same rut. Somebody was talking, I think it was that, it might have been Wednesday night, I'm teaching a lot of classes lately, so I get them confused, about leaving one job, going to the next job, and the next job is just as miserable as this one, and keeping going over job after job, trying to find the right job, but what they're missing is that they're taking the same person to each one of those jobs. It's not the job.
It's not the conditions that are the problem.
It's the same self-referential ego self that you're dragging around with you. It can only keep recreating the same experience, no matter what it is. You know, you can change the outside all you want. Go live someplace else, have another relationship, have another drink, have another piece of cake, you know, buy a new set of golf clubs. Where's Kevin?
Here.
But it's the same person.
Purify the mind.
But if you purify the mind, if you get rid of, purify the mind, it means you let go of conditioned thinking. You found a way to decondition conditioned thinking. You found a way to let go of your own confirmation bias. You see things clearly. What is seeing things clearly? Seeing things clearly, seeing things in reality, is right view, the first factor of the Eightfold Path. That's what it refers to. Going from a wrong view, which is another way of saying an ignorant view, not understanding reality, to a right view, understanding reality. It's just seeing things differently. Seeing things in right view or skillful view. That came up too. Why do I use the terms right and wrong? Because it has somewhat religious, maybe even Christian connotations. Well, it gets to the point. But I could just as easily say, and a lot of times the teachings are taught this way, skillful view or unskillful view.
Complete.
Skillful effort, unskillful effort. It's the same thing. In fact, in some ways it relates a little better using skillful, but right gets to the point. So we're abandoning, we're finding a way to abandon wrong view and develop right view. Another way of saying right view is a view that is no longer rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. Everything the Buddha taught for 45 years was taught in the context of the Four Noble Truths. The only path he ever taught was an Eightfold Path. And he taught that Eightfold Path so we can recognize our own conditioned thinking and let it go. And each moment, getting back to what Maura, I think this is why she's prodding me along in a good way, get to this point. Each moment holds in it the opportunity, the potential, based on what we're holding in mind, to create the next moment, the next self. So the self, again, getting back to impermanence, maybe another way of saying it, and I used it once or twice, and I'm not sure if it's accurate, There's no such thing as a self. But there is an ongoing selfing.
What?
An ongoing selfing.
Selfing.
You cannot take a self and fix it in place. Mm-hmm. That's what the Buddha means by anatta.
That could conceivably be seen as a verb.
Yeah. So the Buddha never said that there's no such thing as a self. He simply said what you think of as self isn't it. It's not a self. Let go of it. And that from that simple explanation has created all this confusion about emptiness and nothingness, and there's no such thing as a self. The Buddha never said it. He simply said, your views are wrong. Let go of the views, and you'll see yourself clearly. The best example of that is a human being that did it. When the Buddha awakened, he let go of all of those ignorant views. He didn't vanish. He didn't become insignificant. He created an awakened human being that for the next 45 years of his physical existence was an ongoing becoming human being. Does that make sense? There were no longer views that were rooted in ignorance that were driving a life experience of disappointment, disenchantment, suffering. But the Buddha had physical problems and emotional problems all through his life. He died from eating poisoned food, and the description of it is he was in excruciating pain. But his mind never left that state of equanimity. He understood what was occurring. He understood it completely. He understood that he was poisoned. And he said, don't say anything about this to Ananda, because he didn't want the man that was generous enough to give him his last meal. He didn't want to hurt his feelings. Talk about compassion. He also knew it was the end of his life. About 90 days before the Buddha was passing, he started talking about, this is going to be my last teaching. The Mahaparinibbana Sutta is one of the longest suttas because it encompasses the last 90 days of the Buddha's life. It wasn't just one teaching. He knew he was going. He knew it was time to go too. He wasn't hanging on to anything. He also said, and he said this repeatedly, he said it when he first awakened, and then he said it repeatedly throughout his teaching and at the end of his life, this is my last birth. He was re-emphasizing, put it into people's heads, this is the time you need to awaken. I did it and I don't have to keep doing this again. This is my last time. I'm done. I'm good to go.
Tom, don't you think that maybe some of the ideas of emptiness and etc. come from meditative experiences where one has a conditioned experience of there's no self. I mean, I know that's not the end. That's what the problem with that those teachings. That's not the end. That's not final liberation, etc. But can that? It's not so much. You can hear it intellectually. Oh, there's no self, etc. And understanding. Like you make it very clear. I think that's one of the beauties of being able to see how anatta gets created and how to work with anatta skillfully. And in some of the deeper absorptive states, there is a sense of, we've all had it, even fleeting.
No,
where there isn't a thought of self-referential, or mm-hmm. when you're in flow or something like that, or we know, and that the Buddha said, watch those skillful, watch that, pay attention to the conditions in which these things arise and which they don't arise, and when you're free of tension and dukkha, and when you're not.
When you're referring to the absorption, the Buddha taught the jhanas, meditative absorption. The final jhana, does everybody know what I'm talking about? The jhanas? Jhanas? The Buddha taught four levels of meditative absorption, and again, these are usually over-exaggerated. The final level, the deepest, profound level that we can develop with our human minds is not emptiness. It's equanimity. It's a mind that is constantly, equanimity means in balance. It means that it's no longer prone to agitation in any way. That's the goal of the Dhamma. When the Buddha described an awakened human being, He described that human being as unbound or released from clinging, and that's the teaching on emptiness, but I'm going to expand on that a little bit. And he described the quality of mind of an awakened human being as calm. And think about that. Isn't that what we really want? Isn't that what we're chasing our whole lives? To have this peaceful, calm mind that's not affected by what's going on outside? Isn't that why we try to acquire a lot of things so we can hopefully control what's out there? And we find that that doesn't work. But through the Dhamma, we can develop that calm mind. The idea of having that self fall away in meditation, it's a wonderful experience. But what's happened is that experience has then become an extreme view. The Buddha said this, the Eightfold Path is a middle path through these extreme views. It avoids the fixation of nothingness and emptiness and chasing that as a goal. Recognize that everything is in a process. There's no such thing. The last retreat we did, I had it up on that board. The last retreat we did here was on emptiness of clinging, which is how the Buddha taught emptiness. You must empty yourself of clinging. And the other way that he applied it is empty the world of yourself. Don't cling yourself to the world. That's how he used emptiness. Not that there was an environment that we should aspire to. And I'll just give a quick story on that. About
I was saying that maybe that's where anatta, the sense of no self, also comes up. I understand
it does.
It
does. It's reasonable to see it that way too. It's easy to get confused. When things are taken out of context, it's very easy to think that the Buddha is teaching no self or emptiness this way. In about 250 years after the Buddha passed, there was some dissension. There was always dissension in the ranks, but the Mahasanghikas, which were a relatively small sect, but still part of the Buddha's lineage, part of the Sangha, wanted to relax the monastic rules, and they wanted to start establishing a more mystical type of Buddhism. And they wanted to establish the Buddha as a God-type Buddha in a infinitely long lineage. In other words, Buddhas, awakened Buddhas as gods stretching into the past and into the future. And so they did. And that was really the beginning of the later developed schools of Buddhism. It was that strict split at the time, a little bit after the Buddha's teaching. So I'm not putting down what developed. This is just what happened. These are historical records. And part of that, their need for this mystical and esoteric type of Buddhism, was to start establishing mystical realms. So they almost immediately diminished, at least in importance, and really dismissed the teachings on the Four Noble Truths, and started attaching themselves to some of these more esoteric ideas, like anatta as not self, but as no self. And I won't get into the implications of that, but that was the beginning of creating a more mystical and magical application of the Buddha's teaching, dismissing the Four Noble Truths. But when you keep things in context, and I think many of you who took the course, and this was my own aha moment too. It's a reason why I wrote the book the way I wrote it. For years and years and years, I wandered around in Buddhist samsara, getting more and more confused and more frustrated, kind of like the Buddha did towards the end. Because I was putting in all this effort, but I was becoming more and more confused. Things didn't seem to fit in any way. I didn't see any real direction in this, except what I was told was that, you know, you do this for endless lifetimes and eventually Buddha nature arises. So I was kind of chasing that. But out of frustration, I said, this can't be it. I cannot believe that a human being that awakened would teach something this confusing. And it was at that point that I said, I got to find out. There's got to be a way to figure this out. And so I started reading the Pali Canon. And it's awful. It's a tough read. But there's a lot of beautiful things in there. At some point, Rama's muddling through right now, aren't you? Mm-hmm. At some point, and I remember this very clearly, how it, what hit me was a consistency of the teachings. And when I started relating these back, I probably read the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta 300 times, because these are the truth, but where is it? Where's the truth in here? But by developing a little bit of understanding of the rest of the Buddha's teaching and keeping it in context with that Four Noble Truths, it all made sense. Anatta made sense. I still had it in my mind that because of the training that I had, that Anatta means no self. I was still stuck in emptiness and nothingness. But when I put it in the context that the Buddha was teaching and started understanding the three marks of existence, then it made sense. He wasn't teaching no self. He was teaching that my views of self are not a self. Let go of them, which is exactly how he describes Anatta. Let go of those views. Even though I had read about the Eightfold Path, nobody said that you need to direct, this is the path, you need to develop it. In fact, it was just kind of mentioned. But when I read it out of the Pali Canon, the way the Buddha presented the Eightfold Path, he presented it this way. He presented it in relation to mindfulness. He said, when you're engaged in wrong view, be mindful of that and enter and remain in right view. And then he described what right view is. Right view is understanding suffering. I think I can do that. I think I can understand suffering. I think I can generate right view. Up until then, I thought right view was some kind of cosmic understanding of seeing my navel on Pluto. I had no idea what it might be because nobody told me. And I was a pretty diligent practitioner. I don't mean to denigrate anything. I was doing this. You know, I engaged in this myself. Nobody forced me to do it. When engaged in wrong intention, be mindful of that and enter and remain in right intention. Then I looked at what is that? Right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. It relates to the second noble truth. It makes sense. Nobody ever explained it to me like that before. But here it was, in black and white, in a set of books that was recorded, well, it wasn't recorded until a few hundred years after the Buddha's death, but it was established during the Buddha's time. And the truth is there. It's right there. It's in black and white, and it's easy to understand, as long as I can get it through my thick, conditioned mind. And that was the big challenge. So that led back to this whole idea of emptiness. Excuse me for just a minute. My iPhone's saying I need to do a software update immediately, but I'm going to trust in impermanence and leave it go. I got a call about, this will be the end of the talk. I don't want to get too late on the first night. I got a call about a year and a half ago. You might remember because I think I told you about this gentleman who had heard of me. I never met him. He never came to any class, and he still hasn't, even though he said he would. I could tell he was in desperate states on the phone. And he said, I'm 38 years old. I got a beautiful wife. I think I remember two or three kids. I got a beautiful house. Lives in Newtown, Pennsylvania, which is one of the nicest places in the world to live. I got two cars. I got everything. I'm living the American dream. And he says, and I feel like I got nothing in my life. And he says, and I've been meditating for 20 years. And immediately I'm starting to think, I think I know what this guy's problem was. I says, well, tell me what your meditation method is. And I'm not going to say the school, although I usually do, because I don't want it to sound like I'm trying to put that school down. But he said, for 20 years, I get my meditation and I focus on nothing. And I said, wait a minute, will you say that again? He says, well, for 20 years, I meditate and I focus on nothing. And I could almost hear the light bulb going off in his head over the phone. He said, holy, for 20 years, I've been focusing on nothingness and that's what I have in my life. The Buddha didn't teach nothingness. He taught to understand the incredible magnitude of human life in a way that we can be fully present with it. That we can enjoy the beautiful house and the three kids and the two cars and the great job without being attached to it. Just as much as we might enjoy having to sleep in a tent tonight because things aren't going so great. It's just what's occurring in the present moment. We're not thrown by that. It doesn't affect who we think we are and who we feel we are. We recognize through the four foundations of mindfulness how that process of form, feeling, thoughts impacts the quality of our mind. Because we see it. We develop the deep concentration and the refined mindfulness within that framework of the Eightfold Path to see things clearly. That's what the Buddha taught. And that's what we're going to develop this weekend, I hope. And more is not here, so any other questions?
That's why.
No, that was really an important question to bring up because it led to good stuff. All right. We still have some time and we might as well meditate, huh? So is a half an hour okay with everybody? We'll be done around 8:30 or so, maybe a little bit later. Do we need a bathroom break before we do this?
Does anybody mind if we shut that window?
Yep, let's shut it. Was that too much information for a Thursday night?
No, it was good.
Yeah?
It was good.
Tracy? Wasn't too much?
No,
okay. Anybody?
We're not supposed to get it all, right?
You're not. And again, what I did go a little bit beyond where I wanted to go tonight, but I just wanted to lay the foundation for the next 3 days and put it in the right context. And all of that, you know, it's something to just hold in mind. Mindfulness means to hold in mind or to recollect. So we first have to know what we're holding in mind, and that's what it is, you know. Equanimity?
No, you're always selfing. Selfing.
I don't know that I've ever used. Maybe I have in the past, but I haven't used it in quite a while. I think it comes from years ago. I never met him, but I was kind of a student of Abraham Maslow. Maybe you know what it is. Self-actualization.
Yeah.
And that was in a very general way. That was his teaching. He wasn't a Buddhist teacher. He was a
transpersonal
psychologist. Yeah, brilliant man. You know, and interesting things to look at. Not totally Buddhist, but but so that was his. I think his most famous book was Self-Actualization, yeah. And so that's kind of the idea of selfing, that we're in control of what we're going to, the self we're going to actualize, to put it in Maslow's terms. In that way, it does relate to what the Buddha's teaching. It's up to us what we're going to become. Do you want to have a life of lasting peace and happiness? You can have it. It's all up to us. When I first realized that, that was like the greatest thing I ever realized, I ever heard. It's up to me. Because up until then, it was up to a lot of external conditions, might be the right, getting to the right college or having the right girlfriend or, you know, all of those external things will make me what I need to be. Or maybe, in Buddhism, it's often the right teacher or the right lineage or all that kind of stuff. It's just having the right Dhamma. You know? That's all it is. I wonder, is Mark coming back? We'll wait for Mark before we start. Did you happen to see Mark up there?
No.
Okay, so a 30-minute sit is good for everybody. Unlike class, there'll only be one callback at 25 minutes, okay? Is that all right with everybody, too, or would you rather the 5-minute callbacks?
Last one.
I didn't
tell you the
name of that.
What's
a callback? My phone's in my car.
A callback is just a reminder. Put like in class, I might say putting aside thoughts as they arise, yeah, remaining mindful of our breathing. That's a callback.
Okay.
And in class, I typically do it every 5 minutes.
Okay. Can we do it like that every 5 minutes tonight, and then maybe lessen it as the weekend goes on?
That sounds like a good idea. So there'll be callbacks every 5 minutes tonight,
yeah,
and every 10 minutes tomorrow. Good. Yeah. No. That's a good suggestion. So. Yeah, well, I am going to use the gong to bring us into and out of, but I'll still talk us into it too. So, find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. Keeping your back straight but not stiff. Your ears aligned with your shoulders, nose aligned with your navel. And holding yourself very loosely, very gently, very lovingly. Allow yourselves to settle into this room. Settle onto your seats. Settle into your bodies. And settle into your minds. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. Just get a feel for what that's like. To be mindful of your breath and your body. And while remaining mindful of your breath and your body, notice if thoughts are flowing. We're conscious beings, thoughts should be flowing. The purpose of Shamatha Vipassana meditation is to not be distracted by your own thoughts. So when you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. I'll repeat that. When you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. Putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. And we'll meditate for 30 minutes. putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. Putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. Thank you. not following a thought with a thought, remaining mindful of our breathing. If a persistent thought or feeling arises, stay with it for a moment or two. Recognize it as impermanent and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. We'll meditate for 5 more minutes. So that's enough Dhamma for today, isn't it? Just a few quick announcements. Maura is teaching, Maura is leading meditation tomorrow morning at 7, right here. Breakfast is at 7:30 tomorrow. The this, what I'm about to say is completely voluntary, and nobody's keeping record of this, but it would be nice if after a meal, one or two of us went and helped clean up the kitchen. It takes about 15 or 20 minutes. So, and I'll leave you to work that out. If you want to do it or not, that's fine. Again, nobody's watching, but Mark is going to be there tomorrow morning.
you can see me.
You'll coordinate it?
Yeah.
Great.
I have a list.
Yeah, just one or two people after each meal. Nobody needs to do it more than once, unless you really want to, unless you really love cleaning
really,
dishes.
Like, Sean, what you had said, I think was very skillful in terms of really considering your life and your motivation for doing it, what would really serve the greater good.
Thank you.
Some people, like moms, 3-year-olds, need to just sit back and take a rest.
Yeah.
I have 3 children, 3 young children.
That's it.
So, really, consider what would serve.
You bring something really important, and not to single Laura out or anybody. This is your retreat, you know. Do what you need to do. There was something else.
Watch conditioned thinking of those of us that are habitual volunteers.
that's the other point. This is your retreat, and if you feel like you just don't want to put the time in to clean some dishes, don't. Really, I mean, I'm really serious about that. So if it's something that you want to do, if it would enhance your retreat, they'll appreciate it. But it's not expected. Thank you, Mark. You do get a gold star for it, though. any lingering questions? I don't want to go too late tonight, but anything that comes up. Again, anybody want to have a private chat with me, feel free to just let me know. We'll put some time aside to do that. Enjoy your evening. It's going to be nice and quiet, nice cool night for sleeping. And I'll see you all at breakfast tomorrow, maybe at the SIT, too. So, thank you all.
Thank you, John.